Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. As our corporate media bang the Iran war drums louder and louder, and treat the presidential candidates as though they were thinkers and statesmen instead of clowns, we'll turn for some perspective to that fine journalist, filmmaker, and thinker, John Pilger. Pilger shows how the news media act as the propaganda arm of established power, and some of the ways we can fight back. I hope you'll stay tuned. In August 2008, John Pilger gave a speech at the Melbourne Writers' Festival in his native Australia. He speaks of how the establishment press aids and abets established power in its undemocratic, bad, and even illegal policies, specifically the establishment's illegal wars. One of the press's chief ways of doing this, Pilger calls censorship by omission. You simply don't report the true facts that contradict the official balderdash. In America now, we're seeing this with a vengeance in the case of the phony Iran crisis. Facts like Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Everything Iran does with radioactive materials is closely monitored by UN observers. The observers report they found no evidence of any materials being used to develop weapons. The US's major spy agencies have reported in writing that they see no evidence of an Iranian bomb development program. Iran has every right to enrich uranium to the point where it's useful for medical research. To enrich it to bomb-making levels would require a huge increase in uranium supply and in infrastructure. It could not possibly go undetected. Those are some of the facts just about Iran that rarely get reported. Why not? But let's cut to Pilger and a slightly condensed version of his fine 2008 talk in Melbourne, Power, Propaganda, and the Silence of Writers.
There's an important element of black farce in what we do as journalists and writers, and especially in the pretensions of the high and mighty who depend on us to promote their ambitions and to cover their omissions. Now, this requires an empathy with humanity, with us, with our frailties, absurdities, and above all, our rights, along with the deep skepticism of those who exercise power over us. The critical element here is memory. According to the American magazine Time, we now live in what's called an eternal present. It's as if the task of journalists and writers is to keep us fixated on the ephemeral and to limit our horizons to our navels. Look at me, woe is me, page after page of McFreud. It's as if our past exists only as self-serving nostalgia, especially in Australia. And yet what makes Australia different and interesting, its ancient people and the achievements of its political upstarts, have been subjected to an organized forgetting. Who knows the uniqueness of Aboriginality? Who knows that true national independence and pride comes not from gold medals, but understanding the secrets of our own country and doing right by our first people? Who knows that hope and inspiration for our young people come not from flags and the rituals of the 25th of April, but from, for example, the women who led the popular movement to stop soldiers being sent to the slaughter of 1914-18, and they won. For Kevin Rudd to say that there's no higher calling, as he did the other day, than the military, is either stupidity or cynicism, take your pick. Who knows that Australians won the world's first 35-hour working week, half a century ahead of Europe and America, along with the world's first pension and child benefits and minimum wage, all of which are the bedrock of your prosperity and mine. It's as if our political imagination is something to be pacified, not primed. Our two main parties are now virtually identical. They form a facade behind which their shared assumptions are no longer open, it seems, to serious challenge. The role of the media is critical in maintaining this. We have democracy by media, just as we have war by media, culture by media, trial by media, patriotism by media, and silence by media. In this way, the boundaries of so much of public debate are fixed. In almost everything we see, hear, and read in the media, political doctrine is insinuated as a presupposition. Without irony, this is called free speech. In fact, it's censorship by omission. Now let's consider these omissions, these silences. The social and cultural destruction of a whole nation, Iraq, is well underway. It's a Holocaust. At least 1 million people have died. And that figure comes on top of the 1 million Iraqis who died as a result of the blockade of the 1990s in which Australia took part. According to UNICEF, 500,000 Iraqi children never reached the age of 5. Does anyone remember these children? I thought about them when I watched the evening news on which happy Australian families farewelled their loved ones in the Navy as they sailed off to impose that murderous blockade. I thought about these children last Tuesday when the media again showed tearful Navy families as HMAS Parramatta sailed off to take part in what the Sydney Morning Herald called the rehabilitation of Iraq. Rehabilitation? Really? Children die in Iraq, in their hospitals there, because there are no syringes, no surgical gloves, no life-saving drugs, none of the things we take for granted on this cosy winter's night. During all the years of the slave trade, the death toll was less than the carnage in Iraq in the past 17 years. We have no sense of this Holocaust in Australia. With a few honourable exceptions, there are no politicians, no writers, no journalists, no academics speaking out, calling us to account. Just silence. Having denounced the lies of his predecessor, Kevin Rudd is silent about the lie that his government is withdrawing from Iraq. In fact, less than half the number of Australians are coming home. How does this propaganda of silence actually work? After all, it's a media society we live in, one with a lot of media noise. Well, a few months ago, President Bush's former spokesman, Scott McClellan, confessed that almost everything he said about Iraq on behalf of Bush was a lie. What was interesting about this confession was the way McClellan described the journalists who put out his lies. He called them complicit enablers. What he was saying, in effect, was that the media's echoing of Bush's lies and Blair's lies and Howard's lies made the attack on Iraq possible. Let's look at another way. Let's imagine that we journalists in free societies had done our job, that we challenged and revealed and set the record straight. Had we done that, perhaps 1 million people might be alive today. In his classic work, Obedience to Authority, the psychologist Stanley Milgram wrote this, and I quote, "There's always some element of bad form in objecting to the destructive course of events, or indeed, in making it a topic of conversation. Thus, in Nazi Germany, even among those most closely identified with the final solution, it was considered an act of discourtesy to talk about the killings." Unquote. Do you recognize that bad form, that discourtesy? Take the war on terror. 9/11 and Bali were gross acts of terrorism, but they were tiny compared with the state terrorism carried out in our name and which is almost never reported that way. Since 1945, the United States has overthrown 50 governments, many of them democracies. Liberation movements have been crushed, people in straw houses bombed. In Cambodia, 750,000 peasants were bombed to death before Pol Pot took power. All that is documented. Do we regard this terror as terror? Do we regard the siege of Fallujah in Iraq as terror, in which thousands were killed and maimed and in an utterly pointless attack? Do we regard as terror the enforced starvation of Gaza? Do we regard daily threats against the 17 million people of Iran as terror? The American reporter Seymour Hersh described the other day how the White House was trying to provoke Iran into defending itself. One idea of Vice President Cheney was to build a fleet of PT boats like the ones the Iranian Navy has, put Americans in them dressed as Iranian sailors, and let them start a shoot-up with American ships. That should do it, said Cheney. Fortunately, it was pointed out to the Vice President that this would mean Americans killing Americans, and his plan was rejected. Hersh says his magazine, The New Yorker, refuses to publish this important story of black farce. That's how censorship works, by omission. Last November, the National Intelligence Estimate, representing the 16 US intelligence agencies, published a report on Iran. We judge with high confidence, said the report, that in fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program, unquote. Yet turn on the radio or TV, pick up a newspaper, and it's as if this inconvenient truth did not exist. The drumbeat has started. Iraq deja vu. War by journalism. Afghanistan is promoted as a good war. In fact, it's a very bad war. A PR exercise to make Americans feel better after 9/11 and to cover the fact that Osama bin Laden had got away. The cost of this stunt was, according to an investigation by the London Guardian, 20,000 innocent lives. There's also the matter of the strategic control of the energy-rich Caucasus, but that's rarely mentioned. The news is that the good war is drawing the line against evil. There's no human enemy, no national resistance, only something called the Taliban. The Taliban are bad. We are good. Australian diggers are heroes, yet again. That's the story. But what exactly are we and our allies doing in Afghanistan? On the day I wrote these words, American planes had slaughtered yet another wedding party, 47 people, mostly women and children. Wedding parties are a specialty of our side. So far, we've bombed to bits four of them. To many of us, on this cosy Melbourne night, that didn't happen. Nothing ever happened, to quote Harold Pinter, of crimes committed in our name. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. Last year, 26,000 troops, mostly Americans, invaded the beautiful, fragile landscape around Shoalwater Bay in Queensland. Stealth aircraft bombed and the US 7th Fleet fired live missiles and exploded depth charges in areas where endangered species live. Indeed, they blasted away some of the most amazing biodiversity in Australia. This week we've had copious media on the plight of a baby whale, but we've heard nothing about the high-frequency devastation of the sonar of countless whales during this military exercise, and it was the biggest military exercise in Australia since the Second World War. We heard nothing about it. It didn't happen. It didn't happen even when it was happening. It was of no interest.
On New World Notes, we're hearing John Pilger on power, propaganda, and the silence of writers. A couple quick notes on the next section. The Australian government is doing to the country's Aboriginal people now pretty much what the United States government did to our country's Aboriginal people in the 19th century. Settle them on some land, discover mineral wealth on that land, drive the originals off the land and steal the minerals. In Australia, instead of exposing the theft, the establishment media are aiding it by broadcasting the government's lies unchallenged. Pilger mentions John Howard. That's the former Prime Minister. And the television network ABC is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Back to John Pilger.
In 2006, the ABC's current affairs program, Late Line, broadcast lurid allegations of organized paedophile rings of sex slavery among the Mutitjulu people. The program's source, described as an anonymous youth worker, was later exposed as a federal government official, indeed an assistant secretary working in Mal Brough's Aboriginal Affairs Department in Canberra. Brough himself told Late Line, "Everybody knows who runs the paedophile rings." The latest media war on the Aboriginal people was well underway. Even though Brough withdrew his comment, even though the Northern Territory Chief Minister denied the Late Line allegations, and the police denied them too. But the symbiosis between media and government was such that John Howard was able to declare what he called a national emergency and send in the army and business managers into Aboriginal communities in the north. Did Howard really care about black children, whose basic rights he had steadfastly opposed since the day he came to office? Or was there another agenda? What was reported, hardly at all, was that the government was clawing back Aboriginal land rights in the only part of Australia where they exist comprehensively. The Northern Territory contains extraordinary mineral wealth, including huge deposits of uranium on Aboriginal land. Under Howard, the number of companies licensed to explore for uranium doubled to 80. At the same time, the government spent millions appropriating Aboriginal land for the dumping of toxic waste. The Northern Territory borders the Arafura and Timor Seas and their oil and gas riches. Last month, a truth emerged quietly, unobtrusively. Of the 7,433 Aboriginal children examined as part of the so-called intervention, 39 have been referred to the authorities for suspected abuse. And of those 39 cases, a maximum 4 possible abuses were identified. Let me repeat that. 4 out of almost 7,500. There was no sex slavery, and the emergency was the same old poverty and despair and denial of resources for health, education, you name it. Late Line has neither retracted or apologized. Such are the rules of war by journalism. And under Kevin Rudd, the intervention continues. What's more, Rudd's Indigenous Affairs Minister, Jenny Mackey, now threatens to withdraw support from remote Aboriginal communities that are, she says, wait for it, economically unviable. What is it about the Aboriginal story that leaves so many Australians so bereft of decent behaviour and so eager to believe the old myths? To my knowledge, only two journalists, Deborah Jobson and Joel Gibson of the Sydney Morning Herald, have exposed the fact that hundreds of millions of dollars, which the federal government claims it spends on Indigenous affairs, have never been spent or have been used to benefit whites or have gone into actually opposing native title claims. Why do we allow such myths? What have we got to hide? Perhaps we know, deep down, as they say, that the paradise we promote all over the world still doesn't quite belong to us. A hero of mine is Edward Smith Hall. I would make his story obligatory in all media courses. In 1826, Hall launched his weekly 8-page, 8-penny newspaper, the Sydney Monitor. On the front page, in large type, was a definition of a journalist, and I quote, "an inveterate opposer rather than a staunch parasite of government," unquote. I like that. The colony of New South Wales was then effectively a British military dictatorship. Governor Darling, I think, was in charge. Hall was having none of it. He exposed corruption and malfeasance, and he demanded democracy on behalf of his readers. He refused to befriend any politician. He was often in jail pending trial for criminal defamation, which was then the favourite device for suppressing unpalatable truth. Perhaps more than anyone, this little-known journalist planted the seeds of three basic liberties in Australia: freedom of the press, representative government, and trial by jury. So what happened then? Well, another kind of journalism arrived with advertising, and the Edward Smith Halls were declared obsolete, or they were shunted into the margins as not really one of us. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press formed close alliances with the establishment. In America, the first schools of journalism were set up with pretensions of respectability that matched their corporate endowments, and the myth of objective neutrality was spun around the so-called professional journalist. What the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists were trained, perhaps groomed is a better word, to ensure that news and opinion was in effect validated and dominated by official sources. Take almost any major Australian newspaper today. Check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign, and you'll find they're dominated by government and established interests. That's the essence of what's called impartial, objective journalism. Now, this is not to suggest, and I must emphasize this, that independent journalism is excluded, but it's the honorable exceptions. So what can be done? Well, first, we should begin, I think, to recognize the gatekeepers, those who guard the spaces of public debate and see off dissent. One of the sponsors of this festival is the liberal-minded magazine The Monthly. A recent issue devoted 10 pages to a character assassination of the Australian maverick journalist Wilfred Burchett, the reporter who was first to expose the horror of Hiroshima. What was extraordinary about this 10-page assault was that Burchett has been dead for 23 years. The article was an especially Australian blend of hearsay, smear, and omission. A key part of this type of work is the destruction of reputation, rather than a reasoned critique of issues that should concern us all. The author of the Burchett attack was Robert Mann. What struck me about his remarkable 10-page attack on Burchett was how vividly it demonstrated how the gatekeepers of the Australian elite have never really recovered from the Cold War virus that brain damaged so much of our political and cultural life and that still sets the boundaries of political debate in this country. Again, the question begs, what's to be done? Well, let's celebrate those who break the silence, the honourable exceptions. One of my favourites, The Chaser, whose imagination and courage shamed those who remained silent while Sydney was taken over by Howard and Bush and the police during the APEC conference last year. And let's ask some questions. Let's examine the Prime Minister's literary awards. These are meant to recognise, and I quote, the major contribution of Australian literature to the nation's cultural and intellectual life. No, they don't. Dangling a tax-free prize of $100,000, they serve to pacify our cultural and intellectual life. All the titles on the current shortlist of 15 are as safe as houses, including a book on Napoleon. Only 4 of the publishers are Australian, and none of the authors need the money. What a message to send out to young writers. Speaking as a journalist, I believe we need a public movement that monitors, deconstructs, and counters the corporate media. In every university, in every media college, in every newsroom, teachers of journalism and journalists themselves need to ask themselves about the part they play in the misinformation and disinformation that allows great power to have its bloody way. Such a counter-movement within the media could herald a perestroika of a kind we've not known, as the internet has already demonstrated. And the public will be part of it, learning how to decode the news and demand the truth. But we need to make haste. Liberal democracy is moving towards a form of corporate dictatorship. This is an historic shift, and the media and compliant and silent writers must not be allowed to be its facade. If those of us who are meant to keep the record straight and tell the truth and break silences fail to do this, then who will? That great whistleblower, Tom Paine, warned that if the majority of the people were denied the truth and the ideas of truth, it was time to storm what he called the Bastille of Words. That time is now. Thank you.
John Pilger speaking on power, propaganda, and the silence of writers. You can find a link to the video of the complete talk on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. Question authority. Speak the truth, if you can get away with it. Illegitimi non carborundum, and see you later.